Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to author Susan George about her newest book, Whose Crisis, Whose Future? Susan deconstructs who's responsible for the economic meltdown, and she offers healthy alternatives as to what we as citizens should be doing to get out of this crisis.
We're very privileged to have Susan George. She is the author of 14 books written in French and English and widely translated. She is president of the Board of Transnational Institutes in Amsterdam, a decentralized fellowship of scholars living throughout the world whose work is intended to continue to social justice and who are active in civil society in their own countries. She is also honorary president of ATTAC, Friends Association for Taxation of Financial Transactions to Aid Citizens. We're very privileged to have her on our show. She has many books. Her latest book is called Whose Crisis, Whose Futures. We're very privileged to have her on our show. Thank you for joining us, Ms. George.
Hello.
Now, in your book, you pose for us a question of the century. You know, we live in one of the most wealthiest times, and yet we seem to be riddled with problems, whether it's hunger, war, you know, economic downturns. Who are the architects of this crisis, and who should be responsible for?
I call them the Davos class. You know, Davos, the ski resort in Switzerland, where the masters of the universe get together every January and decide how they're going to organize themselves for the rest of that year and the following ones. And I think that they are a tiny class. They are nomadic. They are interchangeable in the sense that if you're the head of a very large bank this year, you'll be asked. But if you're not next year, you won't go. And companies and politicians are so anxious to go. Well, companies have to pay quite a lot to go to Davos, but I think it's a class in the sense that they do have common interests, which they do defend. When push comes to shove, they will stick together, even if they might have, you know, the industrialist might have slightly different interests from the banker. But on the whole, they pull together. And unfortunately, our governments also pull with them. They govern pretty much on behalf of the Davos class. So those are the people that I think are causing all the crises, whether it is financial, ecological, whether it is the growth of inequality, or even the growth of conflicts, because the growth of conflicts is in direct relation with climate change, and we're going to have new sorts of conflicts because of that. One which will be important to Canada is the opening up of the Arctic, which is going to be open 3-4 months of the year, and we know that there will be state conflicts over who controls it and who controls particularly what's under it in terms of oil, gas, and so on. So I think the Davos class is really the responsible party for this. It's their crises, and the crisis is in plural in that title.
We are told of an economic crisis of global proportion. We are told that every person needs to somehow rally behind their governments to try to address the economic crisis. Yet what you're describing is that for too long, perhaps, we have been maintained in ignorance in terms of who's benefiting from these policies of neoliberalism. So let's talk a little bit about how this crisis came about. And in your book, you address key solutions to it. But before we can find solutions, we need to address how those crises are created. What role has the privatization of public resources played in this crisis?
Well, when you speak of neoliberalism, I think you've hit it. Neoliberalism is like a religious doctrine, but it's an economic doctrine, which says that private is always better than public, which I think is total nonsense. It says that the market will always self-regulate and that we should allow it to work its magic because it knows better than anything else or anyone else what is needed and will allocate capital and will allocate people properly. This too is nonsense, as we have been able to see. I think that the Davos class has been extremely clever in placing us all in a position where we are obliged to pay. We're living in a period where the guilty are rewarded and the innocent are punished. And I found a remarkable figure in a paper by two people from the Bank of England, which I think is a pretty good reference, who said that the peoples of the world have paid $14,000 billion U.S. for the bailing out and the reconstitution of the banks for guaranteeing their future. Now, 14,000 million is a totally incomprehensible number, so I translated it into seconds. And if you have a second hand on your watch, and every second is $1, you have to watch the seconds tick by for 450,000 years before you'll reach 14,000 billion. That's how much we have already paid. And now in Europe, for example, this afternoon, I just came home from a very large demonstration because people are fighting to keep their retirement benefits here in France. And that is one way that we're being made to pay a second time. We've already paid in our taxes and we'll continue to do so. But now in Europe, in Greece, in Spain, in France, and in Britain, there are deep cuts in welfare budgets, in education budgets, in health budgets, etc., which simply means that people are being asked to pay again. So I think that the distinction between public and private comes down to saying, well, the private sector has won. The banks have won. They are the ones in charge. And sometimes I say it's a joke, but it's a rather close to the bone joke to say, well, we vote for people and then they hand over our affairs to the bankers. So why don't we just vote directly for the bankers and eliminate the middleman? Because that is what is happening, as far as I can tell, in nearly all of the wealthy countries of the world.
And then the other part, I think, as you point out, is if we ignore the role the citizens play in not only creating solutions to these alternatives, by imagining a different society other than one that's based on unlimited profit and, you know, putting one worker against the other. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the relationship of workers, because we often, in times of crisis, we tend to look inwards and think, well, we have to protect our own interests. So what if we're exploiting the Hondurans of the, you know, the little people in El Salvador? You know, we have to increase our wealth for our own, you know, retirement plans or our own benefits. How would you respond to people who think in that circular argument?
Well, I think that this is a classic reaction. If you look to the previous financial crisis of the late 1920s, 1930s, it was obvious that people were being encouraged to blame scapegoats and to blame people who were weaker than themselves, marginally weaker. In the case of the 30s, it was the Jews, the gypsies, the homosexuals, and anyone on the left. Now, since we're living under globalization, we're being placed in competition with workers from all over the world. And it's true, we don't have international unions, or very, very weak excuses for international unions, so it is hard for workers to protect themselves, and the temptation is to go for total protectionism. I think that some protectionism is warranted when it is a question of having your own systems of healthcare, of education, and so on protected. In other words, having your culture protected and not allowing any private operator to come in to the public service area. That's what the World Trade Organization is now pushing for, and many, many bilateral or regional trade agreements are pushing for. They're trying to get the permission for transnational corporations to go into any area that they like, with no limits on what they can invest and no limits on their power. It would be rather like the NAFTA agreement or the U.S.-Canadian trade agreement, which are among the most brutal in the world, and they are trying now in Europe to copy all of the provisions of the NAFTA agreement, including being able to bring legal proceedings against a government where the corporation says you or some of your measures are actually restricting my present or even future profits. And so that is a feature of the NAFTA, which these corporations are trying to get universally now. That's just one example. But what is less known is that over the last 30 years, there has been a massive transfer from the pockets of workers into the pockets of capital. In Europe, this transfer is on the order of 10 points of GDP. In other words, something like $1.3 trillion every year that workers used to be getting and that is now going to capital in the form of dividends or rents or other forms of reward to capital, the kind of money you can make in your sleep that you don't have to actually work for. And this has been a trend ever since the mid-70s, ever since particularly Reagan, Thatcher, and company. All of the European neoliberal governments have gone in exactly the same direction. And people don't realize that their wages have stagnated in terms of purchasing power because the capital holders, the shareholders, are asking for so much more, so much higher dividends, so much higher percentage of return on their investment, that and corporations have given them this. And so they are actually profiting from the crisis. But this, again, is a very small slice of humanity. It's not most people. So there has been a very silent but ongoing robbery of working people throughout the developed world for the past 30-some years, and I think that this is also what leads to people blaming foreign workers because they have been replacing, and of course there is a phenomenon of delocalization or the threat of it, but I believe, and now I'm moving into the solutions, I believe that if we are smart, we in the North will invest massively in green economy, and that we will then have the creation of jobs which will not be delocalizable and which will profit our own people. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself in this interview, but that would be one of the things I would recommend.
That's a wonderful segue. I think that it's not only important to point out the issues, but also the solutions. One of the key points that we're debating in Canada right now is the level of taxation, the way in which corporations have offloaded their tax burden onto the people. We have now the lowest paying corporations in Canada than at any time in history. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this idea that if we tax the rich, the economy will suffer. And so, you know, there's no other choice but for the people, the workers, to absorb the taxes and to let the corporations run free.
That's nonsense, but it's ideological nonsense, which is repeated over and over again so that people will think that it's common sense. And that's what the neoliberals do. That's what the Republicans do in the United States. They also say, you know, liberty, freedom, and so on, which means freedom from government. Let the corporations do what they want. Let the private sector, let the market be free, etc. They use good words, and they try to convince people that this is the truth, but it's simply ideology which serves their purposes. The corporations all over the world are using tax havens to shelter their profits. They use something, a technique called transfer pricing, where they can put their profits in the low tax jurisdictions and their losses in the high tax jurisdictions. They are exporting capital like mad out of the South, where they often have the cooperation of local elites to send their profits from the South to tax havens. And just to give an example, the top tax bracket in the United States under a Republican president in the 1950s, Eisenhower, the top tax bracket was paying 90% of income above a certain level. Now it's 35%, and the brackets have been reduced as well. So there's money. There's plenty of money in the world. The world is awash in money, but we are not going after it where it is. And the rich also, the corporations, it's particularly unfair when they headquartered somewhere and they don't pay for the public services that they enjoy. I mean, for example, the roads to their centers or their shops or their stores or factories are kept up without their contributing. Their employees have ways to get to them either by public or private transportation that they're not paying for. Their health care, the health care of their employees, the education of their employees, so that they have literate, healthy people working for them, they don't contribute to that either, or they contribute only marginally. There are companies in the U.S. that are large, you know, and are making money and have paid no taxes for 5 or 6 years at all in the United States. So I put a bit in the solutions about something which sounds terribly boring, but accounting, if you look at how it's done, it's not boring because even accounting has been fixed so that international accounting, you can say, okay, here is my activity in, say, Canada, and then just put rest of the world so that you don't have to make clear exactly where your activity is, where your sales are, where your profits are, and where you're paying taxes. It's so opaque. It's very difficult for an individual government to know whether they are being fairly treated by a corporation or whether the corporation is avoiding or evading normal taxation. And this is something which needs a total overhaul. The G20 at first was talking about tax havens and closing them down and bringing back those $250 or $300 billion that should be going every year to different governments and which are not because they are avoided or evaded. But now they're not talking about it at all anymore. They just put some cosmetic changes in and the whole subject has been dropped. And the Canadian G20 was perfectly obviously geared towards not changing anything, not having any new taxes or even collecting the old ones. So we have a lot of work on our hands.
In your book, I wonder if you could address some of the solutions to recovering some of this war that we've been fighting against corporations to keep water and land in public hands.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I've mentioned that figure of $14,000 billion that the taxpayers of the North have already contributed to saving and guaranteeing the future of the banks. Now, I think that normally when you open up your wallet or your purse and you hand some money to someone, you expect to get something in return. In this case, we have received absolutely nothing. And I think that we should be receiving something, and that should mean that banks are either totally or partially socialized, by which I mean that they would then receive orders to devote X percent of their portfolio to investing in small and medium-sized companies that have, particularly those that have an ecological project or a social project. In other words, a project for having a company that's run by its workers or in which there is some form of worker interest in having the corporation function according to a participatory model. This is something I think we should be focusing on because we know that these companies can be very well run. There are a lot of examples of cooperatives throughout the world. Canada has some, but there are some in every country, and we know that they can be successful and that they are fairer to their working people than those that are simply run for the benefit of stockholders. So we should be getting the banks on board to lend to companies with a ecological project. By that I mean alternative energy or alternative construction or alternative motors or whatever, we have all those possibilities on hand. We have the technology we need. We don't have to reinvent the wheel and get the banks under control. That would be the first thing. The second would be massive public investment in a green economy, because there again we know that's where the jobs are, and we know that that is the key to the future, and also the key simply to the future of humanity, because if we allow climate change to continue, maybe Canada will survive, because it might become rather like, shall we say, Texas or Florida today. But most of humanity isn't going to survive, and even the lucky ones in the north are going to be having great problems with climate, refugees, migrations, new conflicts, resource wars. I mean, the future doesn't look very good if we allow climate change to take hold and have a runaway effect. So another solution is, of course, to go after the money where it is. And there's plenty of it. Now, I've already spoken about tax havens. That's one obvious direction. Another obvious direction is international taxation. This is something that my own organization, ATTAC, has been fighting for a dozen years now. Tax financial transactions, tax currency transactions. If we were to tax simply the derivatives that that caused so much of the present financial crisis, as well as currency transactions, we would have the sum of $600 billion to play with every year. And in France, we've now established a coalition with major trade unions and major North-South solidarity and ecological organizations in order to push for this kind of international taxation. Or at least the kind we want. But if we have those $600 billion, can you imagine what one could do? One could repair all the social systems in the north. We could use another third to halt global warming and transfer technology throughout the world, particularly to the south, where India, China, and so on, which are adding coal-fired power plants all the time. And we would have enough to accomplish the Millennium Development Goals, which the UN is pushing for the South. In other words, eliminate poverty, eliminate most of the causes of human distress, and provide a decent and dignified life for everyone. When I was writing that book, I was in a kind of state of perplexity, because I didn't see people mobilizing, but now perhaps we're beginning to see more people joining in a concerted battle to obtain some of these things. I think people got hit pretty hard by the crisis, didn't know where to look, but now I do see signs of participating and getting together to push for some of these solutions. So I think the solutions exist. The question, of course, is how do we mobilize to reach them? How can we make our governments act? Because right now, I have to face it, and so do we all, that the governments are governing on behalf of the banks. They only want to make changes around the margins, and they don't want to do anything fundamental, because business as usual is what their real constituencies want. So we have a tough road, but I don't think an impossible one.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Susan George. She is the author of 14 books. Her latest is Whose Crisis, Whose Futures. Tell our audience how they can access your book.
Well, there will be full details on my site. The book is published by Polity Press. Its English title is Whose Crisis, Whose Future, with a question mark. Its French title is Leur Crise, in the plural, No Solution. That is to say, their crises, our solutions. And my website is TNI, like Transnational Institute, TNI.org/Susan George.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We have
come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.